My guest today is the chairman and founder of a company called Purpose. The company moves people to remake the world. The strategy? Build and support movements to advance the fight for an open, just, and more habitable world. Intriguing, right? And isn't it deeply relevant to the work you do? Many, arguably most of you, are leaders of some kind of movement. Maybe in a movement to end human trafficking, a civil rights movement for equality for LGBT people, a movement to ensure reproductive freedom for women, and the list goes on. You do so much more than run individual organizations, and you must be thinking about your work in this broader context, this more powerful one, that you are a leader in a movement. Considering that angle, will your work be different? Do you engage differently with others in your sector? Do you develop different strategies to get folks to care and get them off their asses to do something? I selected this topic because I believe it is critical that we see ourselves as movement builders. We have to think with abundance about what's possible and what people are capable of doing. Jeremy Hyman's is the guy to talk about movements and campaigns. Since the age of 8 in his native Australia, he has been building movements, starting with fax machines to mobilize people on issues such as children's rights and nuclear non-proliferation. Just that one piece of information about Jeremy pretty much tells you what you need to know. He has activism in his DNA, and his superpower is mobilizing people. Two very, very fine reasons that you should settle in for this conversation. Greetings and welcome to Nonprofits Are Messy. I'm your host, Joan Gary, founder of the Nonprofit Leadership Lab, where we help smaller nonprofits thrive. I'm also a strategic advisor for executive directors and boards of larger nonprofits. I'm a frequent keynote speaker, a blogger, and an author on all things leadership and management. You can learn more at joangary.com. I think of myself as a woman with a mission to fuel the leadership of the nonprofit sector. My goal with each episode is to dig deep into an issue I know that nonprofit leaders are grappling with by finding just the right person to offer you advice and insights. Today is no exception. At Purpose, Jeremy Hyman's strategizes how to harness new social, economic, and technological models to build movements with impact. He has been building movements since childhood, when he ran precocious fax campaigns on environmental conservation and third world debt in his native Australia. A former McKinsey strategy consultant, he has co-founded several online campaign groups and citizen activism initiatives, including Get Up, an Australian political movement, Avaaz, an online political activity with more than 40 million members, and All Out, a global movement for LGBTQ people and their straight friends and family. A trip to the Purpose website at purpose.com offers a remarkable list of campaigns and movements. A global campaign with the UN to fight global misinformation about COVID-19. Building a citywide movement in a city in India for sustainable and accessible transport. Building a more diverse and inclusive climate in the Amazon. Jeremy, you must be so proud of the work that you do, and I'm awfully grateful that you're with us today.
It's so nice to be with you as well, Joan. And I've been looking forward to this conversation.
Me too, actually. So the first thing I have to say is I'm really struggling. I have three kids, and once upon a time, they were all 8 years old. And I'm struggling to imagine an eight-year-old building movements. And I wondered if that, like, did that make you unusual? Did it make you actually popular? Who the hell were you mobilizing? I mean, weren't the kids you knew back then all, like, building Legos and riding their bikes?
Yes, well, I was definitely an unusual kid. And I would say you might think of me as a kind of much less successful Greta Thunberg. You know, that was kind of my youth. And so, you know, I started my activism as an eight-year-old in the 80s, in the late 80s, in the sort of Cold War era, and, you know, won this prize, started traveling around the world doing this sort of late Cold War activism, mostly focused at the time on nuclear non-proliferation. We're all very worried about, you know, World War III back then. And then there was, you know, the very beginnings of the global understanding of climate change, or what we called back in those days the greenhouse effect. So, you know, I was not a normal kid. You know, I voraciously consumed the news. I kind of took the world's problems on my shoulders, and I had a kind of an idealism about me and about what was possible in terms of social change that I'd like to think I've kind of kept all through my life. And that has evolved in many different ways. And of course, as you mentioned, you know, back in the earliest days of my activism, my tools were so much more rudimentary than the ones we have now, right? So getting on the radio and asking people to send faxes was cutting edge in that era. And of course, massively limited the number of people you could mobilize. And so that was sort of my childhood. And it evolved into a whole range of things that I've done as an adult.
Yeah, it's so interesting. I'm always I wonder, where did that come from? So you're 8 years old and you're sort of an unusual kid who's consuming news and feeling this activism, this need to like do and mobilize. I actually just curious, like, was your family like that? Did you have a role model that said, or, you know, that, I'm always curious about where this stuff comes from.
Mm. Yeah, I mean, I think I was definitely the most political person in the family, but I think my family's story is a big part of it. So my father is a Holocaust survivor. So he was born in an attic and spent the first 16 or so months of his life in hiding from the Nazis. So his family, a Jewish family, fled when they were called to the camps. A Christian family hid them in Holland, much like the story of Anne Frank, actually. And very, very luckily, they were not discovered and they survived. And so that story, I think, framed my childhood a lot because, you know, I think my father had that experience, which was very defining. He then went on to make documentary films as a career about social justice issues. And I felt like the way he had taken his experience and universalized it, because the films weren't just about the Holocaust or about the situation the Jews face. They were about all sorts of racial justice issues in Australia, where we grew up, and all over the world. And so that, I think, was a model for me in many ways. And my mother's from Lebanon and also has a sort of immigrant story, and also a story, you know, of course, that involves fleeing from some imminent conflict. So there's a lot of threads there that I think shaped me and probably made me a little bit of an anxious kid in a way, where I knew that the world, you know, that larger events could overtake history and could arrive on your doorstep. And so that made me very aware of the potential for things to go very wrong and made me want, I think, as well, to do something about it.
I'm so glad I asked you that question. My wife is the daughter of two Holocaust survivors, no longer living. And yes, it has shaped her in so, so many ways. And that anxiety and that notion that things can go very, very wrong runs everywhere from whether we've left the chicken in the oven too long all the way to, you know, political divisiveness. So I'm totally with you. And I also just wanted to say too, real quickly, is that GLAAD, the organization I ran for a decade, we used fax machines in the 80s as well. We also, we had a phone tree. We mobilized people to call media outlets and journalists for defamatory coverage of the queer community. And so, yes,
yeah,
there are many, many more tools at our disposal, and how we use them matters. So let's get aligned on terms, so everybody's on the same page here. In fact, in your intro, you talked about initiatives, you talked about campaigns, you talked about movements. How, just, can we do a kind of a clarity on sort of a glossary of terms? What you think?
Mm. Well, sure. So, I mean, you know, I would say when I use the term movements, you know, really we're talking about an ecosystem of actors who are working, you know, toward achieving some larger change. So I think you think of the climate movement, that's, you know, an extraordinarily large constellation of actors, civil society, grassroots activists, large NGOs, you know, individuals in this social media era. It's also become quite individuated. So you've got these individuals who have huge influence and are running campaigns and initiatives. You've got these very decentralized initiatives like the Greta Thunberg climate movement, right? The the Fridays for the Future movement, which is not really a traditionally structured organization, right? And so I think you could think of movements as the ecosystem. You can think of campaigns as the kind of big pulses or pushes that are kind of coordinated and tend to be a little bit more strategically driven. And as you know, I wrote a book and about this concept of new power, which is also a term that I use with Henry Timms. And when we think about new power, we're really talking about that form of power that is decentralized, that is bottom up, that is based on a bunch of these new dynamics that are enabled by, particularly by these new technologies, not always a good thing. And we're seeing a lot of new power be used by the bad guys, frankly. But that's sort of another concept that we talk about a lot in the contrast between new power and old power.
So for those of you who want to learn more about what Jeremy's talking about in terms of new power, and I think he will embed it in this conversation, I encourage you to go back to the podcast episode I actually did with your co-author, Henry Timms, who was then the CEO of the 92nd Street Y in New York. We ended up talking about all kinds of things, including Giving Tuesday, actually. And he is now heads up Lincoln Center in New York, just a vast cultural ecosystem of its very own, in fact. So I'm appreciative of your work, and I think it's very compelling. So clearly the work of movements has fueled you for a long time. And so I was really struck when you and I were talking last week. You said something like the soul is being sucked out of movement building. And it made me want to hear more from you about where we are in this land of mobilizing people with purpose to make real and lasting change. Lots of things have shifted. And I wonder if I could just let you just riff. Like, where are we now? What's different? What's better? What's more challenging? And I'll probably interrupt you as you go, because that's the kind of person I am.
Well, I think a lot's going on right now in 2024. And I say this with about a 20-year view of the way that sort of this sort of movement building work that I've been involved with, which has particularly been about using the internet and technology to mobilize people in new ways. Looking at that 20-year view, right? I think when we started this sort of work in the very early days, back in the 2004 elections here in the US, we were doing some of the very first crowdfunding for campaigns. We put together this extraordinary group of women whose loved ones were in Iraq or had died in Iraq, called the Band of Sisters. And we crowdfunded to hire them a private jet so they could chase Dick Cheney wherever he was. And at that time, there were no crowdfunding platforms. It was really fun. There were no crowdfunding platforms, so we had to make our own website, and then people just started donating. And then we have this extraordinary group, and then crowds would show up wherever the Band of Sisters were to see them, because they had such strength and had such a strong voice on those issues. We've come a long way from there. And in some ways, it's a good thing. Organizations have mastered the use of these tools, NGOs, political campaigns on the left and the right, are doing it. But it's certainly, I think part of what I meant when I said that the soul had been sucked out of movement building is it's become very commoditized. So when we started our, Get Up, and when I was involved with starting Avaaz and these groups, there was just enormous optimism about what these things could do. And when people have the opportunity for the first time to even sign an online petition or write directly to their representative or give a little money to something they cared about, that was giving people a sense of agency. And I remember those early years, when we started Get Up, and we were inspired by MoveOn.org and the philosophy of MoveOn.org. It was almost like a news organization. It was narrating for its members like the stories of what was happening and giving people a theory of what they could do about it, which is really, really empowering. And I think that, flash forward, the environment is much more clickbaity. It's much more, it's sort of just everyone is just in this kind of desperate grab for attention. And there's a lack of sincerity and authenticity in a lot of the communications, particularly by the institutions. You've also got, this big shift, which is, when we were starting these organizations in the 2000s, for example, there wasn't really that social media layer. Now with the social media layer, it's much harder for organizations to break through because individuals often have bigger followings than organizations, like for good reason, right? People like to embody issues in individuals. Individuals tend to be, you know, incredibly compelling. You get to know them in their lives. And that's a really powerful tool for activism as well. But it creates further fragmentation and further competition for attention. So there's all of those dynamics, right? That's one thing. And I'm going to pivot to optimism soon, but let's start there. I think there's another set of dynamics, which is that the political dynamics have really shifted. And, you know, I think a lot of people on the progressive side, like on my side of the world, you know, have had a really tough time of the last decade. So you think about, again, when I founded Purpose in 2009, that was a period of great optimism. You know, Obama had just been elected. There was a belief in what movements could achieve. We'd just seen that extraordinary effort. Then we had the Arab Spring, which seemed, again, like a very hopeful use of these things before that unraveled. And then, of course, the last 10 years, you've had Brexit and you've had Trump and you've had the rise of authoritarianism. You've had the rise of, you know, metastasizing mis- and disinformation and a very different view of what these tools have produced and a concentration of power in the hands of these tech players. So I think the challenge in this moment is, you know, motivation, right, for people. And I think we're going to see it in the 2024 election here in the US. Like, do people have the heart and the gumption to fight on, you know, in this era of very, it's very chaotic environment? So those are the challenges right now, I think. But I think there's also enormous resilience that people have. And when you see those moments where people come together and get something done together, and we've seen this, you know, time and time again on different issues. I mean, you know, just 4 years ago, that extraordinary George Floyd moment and the multiracial coalition that emerged around that and the sense of agency that gave people. Not a simple story, you know, not all of the things that movement sought were achieved, but a moment of enormous, you know, kind of collective action. Or, you know, I remember the moment where Donald Trump was announced as defeated and Joe Biden elected on November 7, 2020. And the way people in New York, where I live, spontaneously came out onto the streets and had an 8-hour long street party as if, you know, Saddam Hussein had just been hoisted up the petard. It was really extraordinary. And so, you know, there is still that capacity for collective action, but it is a difficult environment right now, and it requires some different approaches.
I think I would be remiss if I didn't ask about the role you see AI playing in movement building. That's clearly something that was not available even 10 years ago.
Yeah. So I've just finished a piece with Henry about, which has just been published in Harvard Business Review in the January-February edition, about AI and power and how we expect AI to change the environment. I think there's still a lot we don't know about how it's going to play out, but I do think that AI is likely to have a profound impact on the information environment. You know, and one of the ways we're going to see that is that people are going to build very strong relationships with their, what we call in the piece, their digital significant others. And we mean by that the kind of chatbot style interfaces that serve up irresistible answers to questions, that provide advice, counsel, emotional support, you know, opportunities to act. These interfaces are going to do all of those things. And I think that both is an enormous power grab for the creators of those systems, because they will have enormous sort of sway in shaping those relationships, and, you know, the way those interfaces are programmed is going to have a profound impact, right? And so that, I think, is very significant. And we don't know yet how that will play out, but it will mark a shift from the way people are being influenced in the information environment now principally through social media. So it could be, you know, it's certainly a major power grab, and there's a lot to worry about it. It may actually paradoxically do some things to depolarize a little bit if the programming is not as oriented toward provocation, right? The way that the social media algorithms are. So I think that's a really open question. And then for activism, I think it's very clear already that AI is going to make it dramatically easier to hyper-target, personalize outreach to people so that you'll really be able to address people, you know, almost one-on-one in a way we could never do in the early years of our work, right? Where you were sending an email to 10 million people at once. And so there'll be this capacity to reach people also, again, through these interfaces, potentially, that will be very, very powerful. And of course, as is already well known, the capacity to deceive and the capacity to create disinformation will be supercharged. And so again, part of what will really matter, I think, in this coming few years is how much civil society and movements actually see taking back control of this debate and reining in the power of these unaccountable tech companies as a movement goal in and of itself. And I think a lot of the challenge is that these tech companies are really good at kind of bamboozling the rest of society into kind of accepting whatever comes at us. And the movements in this area have tended to not be that savvy. They've been quite technocratic. They tend to be tech kind of tech nerds talking to tech nerds, right? The doomers versus the accelerationists. But actually, we need people who are really good at talking to teachers and nurses and regular people to say, here's how this is going to affect your life, and here's how we need to organize to get ahead of it, right? And I do think that the writer's strike that we saw recently offers some hope that we can organize and push back around this, even though they didn't get everything that they wanted, if we get ahead of these AI dynamics.
Very interesting. You said something a few minutes ago that I wanted to come back to, and I feel like there might be a connection, and you'll tell me. You talked about a concern about the lack of authenticity, right? And when you think about AI, and I listened to you talk about it, I was going to ask you where you think what's the systemic root of this lack of authenticity? And then sort of, do you think that AI could compound that issue?
Yeah, I mean, I think the systemic root of the lack of authenticity is incentives, right? So, you know, I think in civil society, incentives are, you got to build up your own organization, you've got to raise money for your own organization. There's understandably kind of a scarcity mindset. And that tends to lead to, you know, and very little happening at the ecosystem level. So everyone's in their own organizational box, you know, duking it out and, you know, kind of competing for attention. And the amount that's happening at the level of like, what does this issue need? Not what does this organization need, is often lacking. And that's why at Purpose, you know, we've moved a lot in our focus to creating infrastructure at the ecosystem level. So, you know, we call them labs or hubs that are actually thinking about the issue and can work with organizations and other players across the sectors. But where our incentive is, how do we shift the dynamics of this issue and shift audiences on this issue, not how do we make one organization's brand better, or how do we help one organization raise more money, right? So I think that that's inherent in the system, and the AI dynamics only reinforce that because they'll be used to kind of to do that. And I think that's also true in the social media environment, right? You, at some level, you get more authenticity when it's an individual influencer saying, here's why you need to take action right now on this issue or that issue. But you also have this kind of commoditization of behavior there too, because those social media influencers also need to behave in certain ways to attract attention. And that leads to them being more provocative or kind of very narcissistic in a way, you know, in order to attract that attention. And so there's a lot of dynamics that sort of reinforce each other to create this lack of authenticity.
Very interesting.
The Nonprofit Leadership Lab is led by Joan Gary and is the world's best online community for leaders of small nonprofits. Learn how to raise more money, build the board of your dreams, grow a large audience of supporters, and so much more. To learn more and request an invitation to become a member, please go to nonprofitleadershiplab.com nonprofitleadershiplab.com/podcast. That's nonprofitleadershiplab.com/podcast.
So we are talking with Jeremy Hymans, who's the chairman of Purpose. And it is an organization that strategizes how to harness new social, economic, and technological models to build movements with impact. And I wanted to bridge off of what you just said about teachers and nurses and talk about who we talk to and what we say. And so let's start with the what we say. I mean, so much of movement building is about messaging, right? To engage a large group of people who are going to take action and to speak to those whose hearts and minds must change for things to be different. I thought your comments last week when we talked were really interesting, and I wanted listeners to really hear about what you've learned about the messengers that can have the most impact. And I actually think it kind of ties to authenticity a little bit too.
I think the sort of in today's environment, kind of message, messenger, and media, you know, channel, if you like, they're all kind of deeply connected, right? And part of that is about, again, it's about reaching people with the right message from the right messenger in a place where they're going to receive that and pay attention to it and for it to really connect with people. And I think what part of what we were discussing, Joan.
We were talking about the example you were using was you were talking about the refugee work you were doing.
That's right. So part of what we've learned in our work at Purpose is that sometimes the messenger that is most effective is not necessarily the most virtuous, if you like. So I'll give you a couple of examples. So in the refugee space, right, you know, a lot of the traditional messaging on refugees, and Purpose has done a lot of work on refugees over the last 15 years, was, you know, you center the refugee, or you say, here is this poor refugee, look at how they're suffering, please help, right? And that's powerful for some audiences, you know, particularly liberals and progressives. They like that appeals to them. Those values of compassion and empathy are kind of, you know, spike. The problem is, as we know, we're not winning just with the liberals and progressives. So in the example of refugees, what we found in our work was that if you tell the stories of the welcomers, so the people within communities who have welcomed refugees, who appear to be quite different to them, into their communities, that connects with some of those non-liberal audiences and helps them, right, become much deeper supporters of welcoming and accepting refugees. So, for example, you know, we told the story of a German Catholic family, quite conservative, who sponsored a Syrian family, helped them integrate into their town in Germany. You know, they became really close. They stayed with them for a number of months, I think it was. They built a relationship. And what they realized is they shared a bunch of values. You know, they shared values like a belief in faith, sanctity, tradition. These are not words, by the way, that appeal to liberals, but they're words that appeal to some of the very people that we need to move on these issues, right? And so part of the tension, and I think we discussed this last week, Joan, is that progressives often want, for good reason, for the voices of marginalized people to be the voices that are heard in these debates. And that's incredibly important, but it also sometimes doesn't get you the political outcomes that actually would serve those marginalized people best, because for some audiences, you actually need to hear from people that are different to that in order to really connect with them, right? So for example, when we were organizing on climate change in Poland, we did the political analysis and the public opinion research, and it was very clear that the people you needed to shift were, again, in that case, very conservative Catholics, because they're the swing constituency in Poland politically. And the way you speak to Catholics about climate change is totally different, right? And we use the scriptures of John Paul II, because that's the Pope that obviously the Poles, you know, consider the greatest, right? And we embedded everything in a totally different frame and language. So again, I think it's like being really thoughtful about when is, you know, there are moments where, you know, a more traditional liberal progressive message or, the voices of the marginalized themselves are the winning strategy. And then there are moments where that's not the winning strategy and we need the flexibility in our movements.
I'm thinking back to what you said about the Band of Sisters and chasing Dick Cheney. And I'm also thinking back to my own work in the LGBT movement and Dick Cheney's voice when his daughter came out. And all of those folks who had LGBT family members who were not necessarily progressive. And it's some of the work today that an organization like PFLAG does to really mobilize those people who went on a journey and are now, as you described it, welcoming or supporting or embracing. So that, you know, every movement has that same lesson to learn.
Yeah, and sometimes it's not as easy as it should be to pursue those strategies, you know, within progressive movements, because people are like, well, we disagree with them on these other issues. And those disagreements are really important and sincere, but we also need the capacity to do that kind of work. And I think, as we all know, sometimes the left kind of, particularly I think at the moment, is sort of, you know, kind of competes with itself on ideological purity. And that is not very welcoming to the people we need in these movements.
It also reminds me, you also said something about values and shared values. I mean, that is, if the needle has moved on same-sex marriage because the movement's messaging shifted from rights to values, right? Because values is something that there was a commonality there about what marriage meant to everyone. So this, all of this totally resonates.
That's right. That's very true.
So clearly movements are not the sole purview of progressives. And I'm thinking about the conversation we had about the pandemic and the anti-vax movement, which I'm just completely fascinated about. And I just wondered if you had insights on how that movement operated, started, or grew. I think it would be kind of interesting to hear your thoughts on that.
Yeah, well, I've been involved on that issue for a while. In fact, we wrote an article in the British Medical Journal the year before COVID saying, beware the anti-vaxxers, you know, that they really could undermine public health around the world. We know what was coming. And so I think that the anti-vax movement is a perfect example of the kind of new power dynamics of our age, right? They're not that large in numbers, right? The actual activists, but they're very well organized, they're passionate, they have a sense of belonging and identity that it's a conspiratorial worldview. They know something that the rest of the world doesn't. And it's very appealing to hold that worldview, right? And they're organized online. And you only need a small number of well-organized disinformation actors to kind of contaminate the environment. So if you look at the kind of math of disinformation, it's a small number of accounts, small number of voices, but that then gets shared unwittingly often by people who, you know, by someone who's not very well informed, who sees it and then shares it with their family and friends, and then it sort of metastasizes. And so I think that's one dynamic. So part of what, you know, to me that underscores the need for is we can't in response to that just declare the facts from the top down and hope that people will be moved by those facts. So this work that Purpose did with the UN, an initiative called Verified during the pandemic, was actually a really extraordinary effort to combine all of the institutional reach of the UN system and their scientists and their experts with much more modern techniques of reaching people, much more individual and targeted. Speaking, if you are a young man in India who is vaccine hesitant, we're going to find a messenger that you already are engaged with, like a YouTube comedian in India, rather than, you know, a PDF from the World Health Organization, right? And so tactics like that at scale, right? And we ended up building it into something that operated in 60 languages that reached well over a billion people, you know, and that kind of work, I think, is what governments need to do to counter disinformation. It's what movements need to be really good at doing. And it's kind of a day in, day out effort to create content that is as compelling as the content that those disinformation actors create with some of the same sort of distribution strategies. So I think there's a lot to learn. I think that what we've seen on many issues, I think one of the things we're up against is that all these ideological currents on the right start to kind of blend in with each other. So the anti-vaxxers, the gun rights advocates, the white supremacists, the climate deniers, they're not all the same, but boy, is there a lot of overlap in those Venn diagrams when you actually study the way the social media communities are intersecting, and then they're cross-contaminated. And so I think part of what's happened since COVID is the anti-vax sentiment has gone way up, and it's kind of intermingling with a larger worldview around, you know, government conspiracies and they're out to get us and microchips and all that kind of stuff. And that, unfortunately, you know, is being enabled by political leaders, right? By Trump, by Bolsonaro in Brazil when he was in power, and others. So it's going to be much more challenging next time there's a major global public health emergency, because I think the foundations have been laid for even more resistance to sort of reasonable public health interventions.
We are just about out of time, and I could listen to you talk about these examples, and I think they'd be so instructive to everyone. Let's end with optimism, shall we, Jeremy? And
let's do it, Jeremy.
Let's do it. And what are you hopeful about, Jeremy, so that folks who are listening, who run these NGOs, board members who are part of these NGOs, can both benefit from your insights, but also just kind of really take it and feel optimistic about where we're at and their place in it?
Well, look, there's no doubt that this is a difficult moment in the long arc, but there's also a lot that I think we can look forward to. When I look at the climate movement, I see one of the most extraordinary movements in the history of humanity. You know, just the vastness of the people, not just in civil society, but in business and in other places that are working on solutions and trying to solve this. And I know it feels incredibly daunting, but I also think that there's a lot to be optimistic about the trajectory of clean energy coming on board and the ways we might solve a problem like that. I think about an issue like LGBT rights. And even though we're in this period of great backlash and retrenchment at the moment all over the world, you know, I see the gender issue as something that offers some hope. Like, young people have a much less stringent view of gender roles, gender dynamics, you know, and that's an opportunity to bring in not just LGBT people, but straight people who are also, you know, getting the wrong end of the stick with all of this toxic masculinity and these gender roles. So I think there's a lot of work that is possible there when you have young people who are no longer conforming to these very strict ideas of what it means to be a man or a woman in these extremely straitjacket type roles that have been created for people, and what it means to be gay or straight or the many things in between, right? So I think there's some really interesting social changes happening there, which are not easy for people to accept, and they're going to cause a lot of disequilibrium, but where there is also hope that some of those things will ultimately lead to people having more of a sense of being who they want to be, and everyone, not just LGBT people, but straight people too, having better, more liberated lives from the sorts of toxic stereotypes and expectations that we've all been living under.
I couldn't agree with you more. And it is on that note that we're actually out of time. And I guess I just want to say that far too often, and I ran an LGBT organization, and far too often you get very organizational centric, right? Is you've got to fuel the beast. You've got to, you know, you have stakeholders that you are beholden to. And I really feel like the more that nonprofit leaders can really ingest and embed some of the things you've talked about today into the way they think about their roles, that they're not just that you're not just running an organization. You're part of an ecosystem, as Jeremy said. And I actually feel like that is ultimately way more rewarding for nonprofit leaders, to feel themselves a part of something larger, to think of themselves as something part of something larger, and to behave in collaboration with others in that way. And I'm sure that you, Jeremy, just in closing, have seen examples of nonprofit leaders who have reaped the benefits of thinking like this.
Absolutely. Yeah. And my co-author, Henry, I think is a great example. I mean, the story of how Giving Tuesday started is a story of how he chose not to make it an organizational initiative of the 92nd Street Y, where he was at the time, but make it something that was open to everybody. And that, of course, was the difference between something that went nowhere and something that's had a major impact all over the world, right? And so I think you know, those things, the great thing about that mindset is it also redounds to you and your organization when you do it well, right? It is both the right thing to do, to think more broadly and at that ecosystem level, but it's also the smart thing to do.
Indeed. Jeremy, I have enjoyed the conversation and listening to you. I'm very grateful for the opportunity to chat with a movement master and to remind us that our organizations are part of something larger. So, Jeremy, thank you so much for your insights. Thanks for all the work that you do. Please visit purpose.com and just dig into some of the case studies there. You'll get insight and you will be inspired, and it tells a great story about what's possible. So, Jeremy, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you, Joan. It's been such a lovely conversation. I really enjoyed it.
All right. Thank you, everyone, for joining us. Take good care. Thanks for the work you do every day, and we'll see you next time. Thanks so much for spending time with me today. I hope you found the conversation valuable as you navigate the messy world of nonprofits. Check out all my other resources at joangary.com. Hope you find them helpful too. Lastly, thank you for the work you do to repair the world in ways large and small. I'll see you next time.